IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. At the Takshashila Institution, we've been tracking developments around COVID-19 very closely. One of the strands that we've been looking at is geopolitics. Today, we look at West Asia, and I have with me Aditya Ramnathan and Anirudh Kanisetty, who have been tracking this space pretty closely. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Pradeek, and thank you for hosting.
Happy to do that. Okay, so for our listeners first, right, let's set some context. So tell us at a bird's eye view or in corporate speak, 30,000 feet level, what's really happening in West Asia? Are there any broad trends that we're seeing in terms of how countries are responding? Is there something that's unique to the region?
Sure. If you flew 30,000 feet over West Asia, it would look pretty much the same. You'd see the fires and plumes from the oil wells, and you'd see the deserts and the oases, and you'd see the river valleys. But if you go in a little closer, I think that what's happened is the two biggest non-Arab countries, which are Turkey and Iran, have actually been the worst affected countries. Both have something like 100,000 officially confirmed cases. Let's take those figures too seriously. The figures are probably much higher. Testing is fairly limited in all of these countries. These countries have not just suffered from the infection, they've actually also been sources of the infection. For instance, in Iran, it supposedly started with a couple of people in the holy city of Qom. Probably one of them at least came from Wuhan. And what's happened since then is that the virus has spread across borders and also into Pakistan and Afghanistan, similarly with Turkey. So you have these two countries which are really grappling with some of the worst of the crisis, though they may have already seen a peak in rate of infections. Then you have countries where there has been a lot of trouble, Iraq and Syria in particular, where you see not just the effects of limited state capacity, you also see these militias and non-state actors really taking the initiative, providing health services and so on. Then, of course, you come to the Arabian Peninsula, the Gulf. These are the oil-rich countries. All of these countries have a pretty decent state capacity and basically have a lot of money. The big exception, of course, being Yemen. Yemen is still at war, basically, but the war is kind of frozen at this moment because there is some sort of understanding that you have to deal with this pandemic first. What's happened there, of course, is that we simply don't know how many infections there are, though the UNHCR did indicate that they believed the infection had already spread quite widely in Yemen. The other big fault line, of course, in the Middle East is between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and that's not going to heal anytime soon, but you see that these countries have, despite their differences, they're focused on controlling the spread of the disease. They've imposed quarantines. They've stopped foreign visitors. They're testing. They're doing contact tracing. So these are actually some of the countries that are handling it the best in West Asia. So really, overall, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah. So Israel is also an interesting case of a West Asian response. I think one thing, Aditya, it's a very good summary, but one thing that really stood out to me while I was studying this was just how deeply domestic politics seems to affect the response. Not just in terms of when lockdowns are announced to flatten the curve, but also in terms of what specifically is being done. Now, in Israel, we actually saw a little bit of, it seemed almost like a godsend for the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. It came just at the time when a corruption trial was kicking off. Very soon after that, we saw the Israeli parliament granting exceptional permissions to the Shin Bet security agency for widespread tracking of Israeli citizens' phones in order to ensure social distancing was being followed. We even saw a little bit of aggression on the border with Palestine. There were a lot of reports coming out about how the Israeli soldiers were not letting testing kits and so on through. But interestingly enough, that seems to have kind of resolved itself. So Hamas Hamas has actually allowed Palestinian doctors to go into Israel for special training to deal with COVID and come back. And one thing also, Aditya, so you mentioned that Iraq and Syria were struggling, but I think it's also important to remember that West Asia has seen massive movements of refugees over the last few years. A lot of countries in West Asia have very large refugee camps. Jordan and Lebanon both have large refugee camps of both Syrians and Palestinians. And these people are among the most vulnerable populations in the world to the spread of the disease for multiple reasons, partly because their host countries are going through an economic crisis, don't really have very robust healthcare systems, partly due to the pathetic conditions that they actually live in. A lot of refugee camps, for example, don't even have running water. And as you guys know, washing hands is extremely important to kind of checking the spread of the disease. Without consistent access to running water, let alone medicines and isolation wards, we might very well be looking at a ticking time bomb in some parts of West Asia.
Yeah, it would seem that these refugee camps are actually going to be or could be future sources of an explosion of infection, because even at their best, refugee camps are sources of infection. You have diseases spreading very quickly and so on. With this pandemic, unless there is lots of provision of water, sanitation, testing, where it's possible we'll see a disaster unfolding.
No, and that's interesting. And I think you mentioned state capacity earlier as well, right? And I know you guys have been tracking this in terms of the annual healthcare and the number of physicians that some of these countries have. So based on that, how do you think this might play out? You know, which are the countries that are likely to have better responses? Where do you see future hotspots emerging?
So as I mentioned, Prateek, so there are the domestic politics of West Asian countries were, at least in the early stages, very, very big players in how the response happened. So we talked about Israel. Now, Erdogan in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is in a relatively delicate political position. Just recently, his ruling Justice and Development Party suffered a pretty humiliating defeat in Istanbul, you know, with the municipality basically going over to the opposition party. And it seems that when there was an understanding that they were at risk of the disease coming to them, the government didn't really feel bold enough to impose lockdowns. Now, that might be a little surprising to us sitting in India, where the government was very, very proactive in imposing a massive nationwide lockdown and enforcing it fairly strictly. Turkey, despite the fact that it sees so much international traffic, keep in mind that it's a major transport hub. It's a major transport hub, not just for people, but also for goods. Even though they knew that the disease was coming, the ruling party did not necessarily feel comfortable with imposing lockdowns over the entire country because it would be extremely unpopular. They start out with advisories. People continued to keep moving to and fro major cities where people were moving. And what we began to see was when doctors began to warn that this was a disastrous policy, that you needed to have lockdowns imposed, that numbers were being fudged, they were actually basically prosecuted, forced to apologize. And we're basically seeing the consequence of that now. We're seeing a massive, massive explosion in the number of cases. Turkey, as Aditya mentioned, has over 100,000 cases. There's no reason to really believe in the accuracy of those numbers. In the rest of West Asia as well, if you look at Jordan was extremely proactive in imposing lockdowns, but now it's starting to feel the economic bite. So it's aiming to reopen its economy, and a lot of doctors are warning that there will be a second wave of infections. Israel imposed lockdowns fairly early on compared to a lot of other countries. But as I mentioned, domestic politics was also a big factor in how Israel responded. There was, quite interestingly, a social distancing enabled protest in Israel, which was very interesting to see. There's this beautiful photo of nearly 2,000 people who all gathered together, maintaining a 6-foot distance between each of them to protest Netanyahu's actions. While I would say that as nationwide, Turkey is likely to be a big hotspot, the really big questions for me are what is going to happen in the refugee camps and what is really going to happen in Syria. Now, in Iraq, which also has a similarly depredated healthcare system, at least you have a considerable presence of a lot of international agencies. Militias seem fairly keyed into the situation, are trying to help with the state response. But in Syria, we really don't hear anything at all. We have no idea how prepared the healthcare system is to deal with a crisis. Now, keep in mind that Syria has been through a civil war. The medical system has basically been almost completely appropriated by various sides of the civil war. Doctors have fled Syria en masse. Those who have stayed have either sided with one or the other side of the civil war. Ambulances have basically been repurposed into weapons transporters. We have no idea how testing would be conducted. We have no idea if people wearing PPE were to go into a neighborhood, whether people would actually cooperate and give them samples. We have no idea if people would cooperate with healthcare authorities in isolating themselves or coming to isolation wards, given the fact that they might be worried that their political activities might be used to prosecute them. So I would think, yes, Syria is definitely another potential major hotspot.
Yeah, the only other hotspot I would add to this excellent summary is Yemen. I think Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen are the potential sources of fresh infections.
Okay, that is worrying indeed. Now, you started off with Turkey, so I just want to go back to that. And, with the effects of COVID-19, how do you see the situation between Turkey and Russia playing out?
So it's been quite interesting to see how COVID has kind of affected the geopolitics of the region. As Aditya mentioned, the Saudis basically called a freeze to the war in Yemen. Similarly, Turkey and Russia seem to have come to some kind of modus operandi when it comes to the northeast Syria border. The border of Syria, keep in mind, especially the region of Idlib, is still controlled by rebels. Until late last year, in fact, Turkey seemed very serious about actually physically invading to establish a presence. They seemed very serious about attacking the Kurds across the border and so on. But basically the fact that COVID has broken out, the fact that soldiers moving around, potentially being exposed to a new source of infection that we don't really know about, seems to have put a lid on the conflict for now. Russia has done some things in Syria. It's announced that it's going to be sending ambulances, PPE and all that. But I would take it more as a diplomatic move intended to project itself as a reliable ally to Bashar al-Assad rather than a really strong geopolitical move. In summary, I would say that there is probably going to be some tacit cooperation now, but a lot depends on what happens once the lockdowns are lifted. A lot depends on how well these countries are actually able to deal with their domestic crises. In fact, Erdogan has recently come out and said that Turkey is going to play a major role in the post-COVID world order, which seems like a fairly grandiose statement given the fact that Turkey is still fighting COVID-19. I would suspect that it's really more inclined towards a domestic audience than to really be interpreted as a solid statement of geopolitical intent. I think it's really too early to call the shots on this. I think we'll really have to wait and see. Keep in mind that Russia also is reportedly struggling mightily with COVID-19. We're hearing fairly disturbing reports of doctors being thrown out of windows. Doctors who have criticized Moscow's response are being thrown out of windows. You see fairly disturbing reports of numbers being fudged. We don't really know the readiness of the rural Russian healthcare system to deal with this. So Russia is really not in a great position either. So yeah, it's probably more of a ceasefire rather than a fundamental shift in any player's stances at this point.
Which I guess that's not surprising. Another interesting thing that struck me was, we've seen globally oil prices crashing over the last couple of weeks. How will that play out in Saudi Arabia and maybe the region at large?
Sure. So one country that hasn't really been able to export a lot of oil is, of course, Iran. It's because of the sanctions. Most of their oil consumption is domestic. So that's going to continue. But on the other hand, you have Saudis, Qatar, which mostly exports natural gas, Kuwait, Bahrain, all of these countries, UAE, are heavily dependent on oil exports. And what you're seeing is that basically at these prices, they're very, very far from being able to balance their budgets and support their own social welfare programs. For the Saudis, you need their break-even price is about $80 a barrel, depending on how much oil you sell. Now, obviously, it's cheap for them to get that oil out of the ground. So they can still make a little money off that. But you need to find customers, you need to have storage space. We saw this problem arising in the last couple of weeks. And so there are fundamental limits on how much oil they can sell as well. So you're going to see a very definite impact on the understanding of the pact between these monarchies and their subjects, because they're simply not going to be able to provide the sort of largesse that they are normally able to provide. People will probably not lose their jobs, but a lot of the sort of additional payments that people get, the free healthcare, all these things might see, there might be some strains on these things. And so how that plays out domestically is something we have absolutely no idea about right now, because we haven't heard much really from people in, say, Kuwait or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have been very clever, for instance, in co-opting the religious elites, in imposing restrictions, for instance, on prayer. They're very quick to do this, unlike, say, Iran. As of now, I think the oil prices will reduce these countries' external leverage, and they will also reduce their fiscal space and make them, the low oil prices will basically make them less adventurous internationally. But I don't know of any visible domestic impact yet.
It's also going to be interesting to see how this impacts the Kurds, really, because one of the big financial drivers, as I understand it, for the autonomy of the Kurds was their control over various oil fields in Syria and Iraq. But that is obviously massively, massively impacted by lowered oil prices. It's going to be very difficult for the Kurds to mobilize the financial resources they need to finance a lockdown or even to finance a systematic healthcare effort. And keep in mind that this whole area, right, especially Syria and Iraq, you constantly see a movement of militias. The borders are fairly porous. Kurdistan also seems like a ticking time bomb to me. Now, keep in mind that unlike the rest of the Gulf countries, the Kurds don't really have very good infrastructure. They don't really have the capability to keep their citizens even moderately well off for any amount of time. So that might also be a major change to the dynamics of the region. And while we're on the subject of economic crises, though, I mean, I'd also like to point out Lebanon. Lebanon was already facing an economic crisis before COVID-19 hit them. It was a mostly import-dependent economy, dependent on imports even for food supplies. And the imposition of the lockdowns has basically worsened the financial crisis to the point where even though people are concerned that they might get the virus, you're still seeing reports of very violent protests, banks being burned, calls of revolution on the streets. How that's going to impact the spread of the disease, how refugee camps in Lebanon are going to be impacted, really remains to be seen.
Yeah, just going back to Anirudh, the point that you made about the Kurds, there's another, while we talk about the international oil markets, and that is most of the oil that's sold from the Middle East, there is also a small but important oil black market, especially in Syria and Iraq. And I'm guessing that market isn't doing very well at the moment. And that means that the organized crime groups or the other non-state actors that depend on that black market oil have a lot less cash flowing around right now.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was quite surprising to me, right? So we started researching this in early April, and it seemed then that the central government in Iraq didn't really have too much of a clue. It was mostly the militias that seemed to be taking the initiative in terms of enforcing lockdowns, educating people even, because they saw it as a very useful way to project themselves as authority figures in the area. But the impression I'm getting now, at least from the reports of international organizations, is that the central government seems to have somewhat of an upper edge. It seems to be leading coordination, at least, if not really like spearheading the efforts. And it also seems to be, since it's the major recipient of international advice, international aid, it might very well be that Iraq comes out of this somewhat better than you would expect, given the fact that it has such a debilitated public health system.
Yeah.
So on the topic of international aid, I think that's an interesting point, right? We've seen instances of international aid or funding being lowered. How is that playing out in the region, especially maybe somewhere like Palestine or something?
Yeah, it's been a massive disaster in Palestine. It almost seemed like Donald Trump was waiting for his moment to cut off aid to Palestine. It wasn't even a lot of money. It was only a few million dollars, not something that the U.S. desperately needed for its own COVID response. But there was a lot of alarm raised when funding was pulled. But I would also think that the fact that the U.S. has reduced funding also acts as an opportunity for other players. Early in April, for example, we saw reports that Israel and China were planning to set up a joint COVID testing facility, I think somewhere in the Gaza Strip. So it has been bad. It has, as I said, keep in mind that Palestinians don't really have the best quality of life, don't really have access to running water, for example. Yes, there were some pretty disturbing reports of the sheer shortage of testing kits, of workers wearing PPE and ambulances, like going in and barely having any kind of relief supplies to hand out. But as I mentioned, Hamas seems to have realized the gravity of the situation. Even Israel, surprisingly enough, seems to have realized the gravity of the situation. That's not really a guarantee of success, of course, in fighting a pandemic that's this virulent. But it's too early to say for sure. I would intuitively suspect that it would seriously set back efforts to fight the pandemic. But at the same time, I would remind us all that people aren't just going to lie over and die that easily. They're going to fight the pandemic with all they've got. Whether or not those efforts are successful will only become apparent in perhaps the next couple of months.
Okay, so clearly there's a lot happening in West Asia, I guess, as always. Not very surprising, but you know, how should India now respond to this? What should we be doing to, I don't want to say leverage, but you know, in this scenario, how should we be responding? What steps should we be taking?
Yeah, so West Asia is obviously part of India's sort of extended neighborhood. India has had very ancient ties, really going back to the Bronze Age with West Asia. Today, if you were to ask what are India's key interests in West Asia, you would, of course, number one, you would say energy. Number two, you would say Indian expatriates in the region. There are something like 10 million Indians living in the broader region. And then, of course, there are issues like, for instance, India is interested in things like regional connectivity. Iran was supposed to be a source of basically inland infrastructure going into Central Asia. We also are concerned about political stability in general in the region because we are concerned about, for instance, religious extremism. Then West Asia is also part of the rimland of West Asia, is also part of the Western Indian Ocean region, so it impinges on maritime security. For India, I think what we need to understand today is that there are both, I think, challenges and opportunities. I think that one of the most obvious challenges right now is, you know, you have Indians living in the region. Many of them are workers living in fairly cramped conditions in camps, using in communal living spaces. And a lot of the disease spread, the COVID-19 cases that we're seeing, especially in the Gulf, comes from these places where a lot of Indians and other people from the subcontinent are living. So we need to ensure that these people get treatment. We need to talk to those governments, maintain good relations with them. B, there are people whose work permits have expired. And so we need to talk to these governments to give these people some sort of amnesty and then get them out of there and bring them back to India. And then there are people whose work permits might expire. So we need to think about that, how to get them out, plan for it. And finally, those who remain there, we need to talk to those governments to, you know, to keep those people there, to not start sacking people. You know, a lot of governments in the Gulf have been talking about replacing expats with locals. And I think that it would be in India's interest to tell these governments to simply go slow on those efforts in this difficult period. But I think whatever happens, you are going to have a lot of people returning to India. You'll have fewer people going to the Gulf in the coming year or so, which means that we are going to see some sort of losses in remittances. The West Asian region probably accounts for more than half of India's total remittance income. So that is a lot of money, something like $40 billion. And, you know, as fiscally, we need to prepare for that. In terms of opportunities, I think obviously, like you said, Prateek, there's oil. The very fact that oil prices are low means that, you know, it's less strain on us. And we should really negotiate aggressively with these countries to get oil, to secure contracts at attractive rates. And, you know, if oil prices start rebounding, which is possible, we should start having conversations with these countries about the so-called Asian premium that they, which is basically an extra bump on the price that they add to per barrel of oil. This would not be a very unreasonable request, because the reason that Saudi Arabia themselves, for example, say that they don't impose this on Western Europe or North America is because they consider those countries to be allied in some respects. Now, India is very much part of Saudi Arabia's new geopolitical environment. India is very much part of India is very much one of those 10 key countries that the Saudis identify, for instance, as strategic partners for their Vision 2030. So I think that India is in a good position to talk about reducing that Asian premium. So I think that is one key opportunity. The other is simply the fact that India is a major player in pharmaceutical manufacture, vaccine development, vaccine manufacture. And we need to leverage the strength of ours, not just to provide for ourselves, but also to provide assistance to countries in this region. Now, India has already been providing hydrochloroquine, for example, to countries ranging from UAE to Jordan. But if tomorrow, say, an antiviral drug or maybe some new antibody treatment is approved, India needs to start thinking about not just manufacturing that for itself, but also for these other countries. And finally, one day, you know, being optimistic, if there is a vaccine, then of course, India will probably be and should actually ensure that it is a supplier of choice to these countries.
I have one minor point to add, Aditya, to what you were saying in terms of the fact that Saudi Arabia sees India very clearly as being a part of its alignment of strategic partners. I think it's really time for India to take a call on whom to side with in the Iran-Saudi rivalry that's playing out in West Asia. The way that I understand it is that Iran is so severely affected by the pandemic that it might very well be quite a while before it starts to get back on its feet, before it starts to be a really major player in the region, even though its militias are still operating and so on and so forth. And especially given the fact that compared to Saudi Arabia, Iran is simply not going to be able to offer us oil because of international sanctions. Iran is simply not going to be able to offer us infrastructure because it's going through an economic crisis. And given the fact that India is going to need enormous amounts of capital to really kickstart infrastructure projects, to really kickstart its economy once we've dealt with the pandemic, I would think that it's time for us to like really start leaning towards Saudi Arabia and trying to figure out the potentials of what that partnership could have in store for us.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think India has already started doing that in the last few years. India has made bets on some key countries in the region, specifically Saudi Arabia, UAE and Israel. And this clearly leaves out Iran, which has actually been a very traditional partner of us. You know, we have an emotional connection, cultural connection to Iran. But at the moment, it's simply not as important a player for India. One reason is, like you pointed out, the sanctions. That doesn't just affect our economic interaction, which has now become quite minimal. It's also, for example, the fact that look at Oman, for example, which is another important Indian partner. India can have a refueling, restocking agreement with Oman at the port of Duqm. And that allows us, that increases our reach in the Western Indian Ocean region. Now, we can't have a similar agreement, even if we want to, with the Iranians, right? Iran is a country under U.S. sanctions. The Iranians at one point did look to India for potential naval cooperation. But I think that's completely out of the question today. And so there are fundamental limits economically, strategically, to our ties with Iran. So I agree. I think India has already made this bet. And this is going to get more obvious as time goes along. The only potential countervailing trend to that is the fact that A, the Saudis and UAE themselves want to go easy on their confrontation with Iran. And B, if India becomes a major supplier of choice for pharmaceuticals, vaccinations, and so on, that gives us an opportunity to smooth things over a little bit with Iran. You know, we always want to manage this relationship. We certainly don't want to be enemies with Iran.
Yep, well said.
Okay, that's interesting. So there's challenges, there's opportunities, there's tough choices to make for India. COVID-19 is not easy on anyone, clearly. So on that note, I think we'll wrap up. Thanks, guys. This great conversation.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.